This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Please join me in welcoming Ta-Nehisi Coates and James Bennett.
Thank you very much, Alyssa. Thank you to Sixth and I and Politics and Prose for convening us. And I have to say, it is remarkable and wonderful to hear in an introduction that, by the way, you've been awarded a MacArthur Fellowship. that should be a footnote is really amazing, testament to the remarkable year that you're having. So we're going to talk for a while up here, explore some of the themes in the book, maybe ask you some questions about yourself, and then open it up to you guys to ask Ta-Nehisi some questions. We thought we might start out reading a passage, if you don't mind, from your Baltimore days, from the early pages of the book.
So I just want to, you're living your life, like you're just going through your daily life, doing what you do, and I've been a writer for, it's 20 years now, and suddenly something like this year happens, and I'm not sure why. I was listening to the biography, it was like listening to somebody else. It's incredible. Thank you guys for coming out. I can't even process why all of you are here. It's tough to understand. Fear is a big component of Between the World and Me. We're going to talk about that a little bit. This is a book that's written in a form as a letter to my son, and it is. I try to be as unsparing in the book as I actually am in conversation with him, because I think that's the only way that we get to any sort of truth. He called me today. He's in school over in Paris. I'm gonna give you some rich people's problems right here. He's in school in Paris, and we thought we were putting him into a bilingual school. It turned out it was not a bilingual school. There was only one other Anglophone there, and that Anglophone transferred out today. problems. And he can barely understand. But see, for him, I'm joking that it's rich people's problems. But see, when you're the kid, and you're 15 years old, and you haven't seen anything else, you have nothing else to compare it to. And everybody else around you speaks a different language than you, and he studied before, but it's different when you're thrown into the game. And I was trying to tell him today, he said, listen, I feel lonely, I feel miserable, this is what's going on. And I, as I say in the book, I made no effort to make him feel better. because it is miserable, and it must be lonely, but in a year you'll be thankful for it. But right now, you're right, it is miserable, and that's like a basis of trust between me and him. And so this book is, I think it comes out of that spirit between me and Samari, that kind of trust, that sort of candor. And so I'm going to read about fear in a very candid way. And I am afraid. I feel the fear most acutely whenever you leave me. But I was afraid long before you, and in this I was unoriginal. When I was your age, the only people I knew were black, and all of them were powerfully, adamantly, dangerously afraid. I had seen this fear all my young life, though I had not always recognized it as such. It was always right in front of me. The fear was there in the extravagant boys of my neighborhood, in their large rings and medallions, in their big puffy coats and full-length fur-collared leathers, which was their armor against the world. They would stand on the corner of Gwen Oak and Liberty, or Cold Spring and Park Heights, or outside of Mundarmin Mall with their hands dipped in Russell sweats. I think back on those boys now, and all I see is fear, and all I see is them girding themselves against the ghosts of the bad old days when the Mississippi mob gathered round their grandfathers so that the branches of the black body might be torched, then cut away. The fear lived on in their practice bop, in their slouching denim, in their big T-shirts, in the calculated angle of their baseball caps, a catalog of behaviors and garments enlisted to inspire the belief that these boys were in firm possession of everything they desired. I saw it in their customs of war. I was no older than 5, sitting out on the front steps of my home on Woodbrook Avenue, watching two shirtless boys circle each other close in Buck's shoulders. From then on, I knew that there was a ritual to every street fight, bylaws and codes that in their very need attested to all the vulnerability of the black teenage body. I heard the fear in the first music I ever knew, the music that pumped from boom boxes full of grand boasts and bluster. The boys who stood out on Garrison and Liberty, up on Park Heights, loved this music because it told them, against all evidence and odds, that they were masters of their own lives, their own streets, and their own bodies. I saw it in the girls, in their loud laughter, in their gilded bamboo earrings that announced their names thrice over. And I saw it in their brutal language and hard gaze, how they would cut you with their eyes and destroy you with their words for the sin of playing too much. "Keep my name out of your mouth," they would say. I would watch them after school, how they squared off like boxers, Vaselined up, earrings off, Reeboks on, and leapt at each other. And I just want to say, like, really quickly about that part. When I was like a young man in that environment, I didn't understand that these people were afraid. That was not my perception. I was afraid of everything. You know, all the behaviors I just named, you know, basically scared me. And it was only later, you know, after looking back on it, that I could see in each of those things what was bluster, what, as a young person, looked to me like power, was in fact actual fear. And one of the things I really, really wanted to do with this book is invert the picture, particularly of young African Americans, because I think rage is what comes to mind a lot of times. I think, you know, violent power is what comes to mind. And to, you know, make it clear that what you are actually seeing is fear. That actually is the dominant emotion that's at play there.
You know, you're describing your the young you, and the still young you now is a celebrated best-selling author, and with all the qualities Lissa described earlier. But you say at the outset of the passage that you are afraid. So how are you afraid? Are you still afraid, and what is the quality of the fear today, the nature of it?
Well, it's different. You know, I mean, you know, I'm older. I have a little bit more control over, you know, my circumstance and my body. I think this really comes out of the spirit of being in middle school, which I think is a particular time, you know, in the mental growth of all people. But I think in the period where that was happening in my life, in Baltimore City in the 1980s and into the 1990s, given what was happening in the cities at that time, it was just a particular point, a very, very violent point. And so it was particularly scary to be there. You know, having more control, less so now, but then, you know, you have kids. You know, and you send your kids out into the world, and you are, I am, you know, very, very much afraid, you know, for my son. You know, and there's the normal fear, which, you know, for instance, you know, I felt today in the conversation I was having with you, I think all parents feel. And then it is the fear, like when we're at, you know, at home in Harlem, and your kid goes out, you know, to school, and you know what kind of neighborhood Harlem is, and you know what happens in Harlem, and that's a different fear. That's an extra layer that I think comes with, you know, being African American in this country.
Did you ever have a lot of fear as a writer? Did you have to conquer any particular fears? I'm not saying even to advance a controversial argument or something like that, but just to believe that you had something to say that the world wanted to hear.
You know, I have a story for you about that.
Good.
I had a piece to do for an editor who used to be with us, James Gibney. Uh-huh. And I kept asking for extensions. And he said to me the last time I asked, he said, "No." Said, "No, if you don't turn this in by tomorrow, I will go to James Bennett and I will tell him that I have no confidence in your ability to deliver this piece." And I said, "Oh my God, that can't happen. That can never be said about me." And I churned it out in a day, and the piece ran in a magazine like 4 months later. And what I got was that I was afraid that in fact what I was doing, that I did not need more time, that I did not need to think things over, that I had not figured it out, that I was just afraid, that I was literally afraid that, you know, it was going to be terrible, that I couldn't do it. That actually was a big growth piece for me, because then I could see the whole process. So I'm not really, like, I do get afraid now, but I recognize it as part of the process, and I just, you know, write right through it. You know, it's actually one of the things I try to impart on students when I'm teaching. You know, that it is natural to sit there and be afraid, but you got to do it in spite of it.
And how about the writing of this particular book? You said in one of the interviews you gave over the summer that you wouldn't have written this book in 2008.
Right.
But you've changed.
Right.
So what? How did that happen?
Well, I think a couple of things. I mean, one of the benefits of working for The Atlantic was, particularly at the time, when I arrived, we were, I think, really trying to figure out who we were. So there was a lot of room, you know, for creativity. I think there's still room, you know, now, but it was like really, really entrepreneurial. There was still such a thing as a blogosphere in a big way, and we were trying to participate in that and figure out where we were in that. And so I, you know, had this space, you know, at The Atlantic, this blog, which I could utilize however I wanted, and I, you know, basically utilized it. There's no other way to say this, to educate myself. By which I mean I spent a lot of time in conversation with, you know, readers of the magazine, readers of the blog, you know, about, you know, various subjects, and one of those being really, really close to my heart, you know, American history. And it was sobering. It was very, very sobering, and I think, I don't want anybody to take this the wrong way, but actually kind of radicalizing. Even more so than Howard University, even more so than all the things that I had experienced up to, it was really that period from about 2008 to about 2012. Because what I came to see is that, you know, we have a way of looking at the world as people, you know, who are Americans and are just, you know, going through life. But historians and academics, they just have, they're so harsh. And there's such a harsh view of the world, and there's no need. I mean, people say to me, you know, about this book and about a lot of my other journalism, where is the hope? And I say, man, if you hung out with who I hang out with, I mean, you just need to go on a campus and just sit in the American History Department just for a minute. I mean, don't go sit, you know, with, you know, you don't have to sit with, like, people that are throwing firebombs or anything like that. Just try to sit through a reasonably good and intelligent survey of American history, say, to 1860, 1865, and then after. It is sobering. I mean, it really, really is sobering. And I think, like, one of the things for me is these were not books that were, you know, on the dustbin. I mean, this is like, you know, James McPherson's, you know, book on the Civil War, you know, which is like a Pulitzer Prize winner, Oxford History of America. I mean, these are well-regarded books, you know, Ira Katz Nelson's book, you know, which won a bunch of prizes last year, Fear Itself. And maybe people aren't reading these books, I don't know, you know, but that, I mean, that period for me, I think it just, it changed my journalism. You know, because it forced me to write in a longer sort of way. You know, it opened, you know, my gaze just a little bit wider. So, yeah, it altered a lot about how I wrote. I wouldn't have written any of this. I wouldn't have written this. I wouldn't have written the case for reparations. I wouldn't have wrote the mass incarceration article like that at that point. I wasn't there yet.
You know, it's funny. One of the things you managed to do so powerfully is to constantly break news to us about our own history. But as you say, this stuff is being taught, it's being read, but it's as though we walk around not knowing it.
I can't understand it. I don't quite get it, you know what I mean? I mean, one of the things that we did this brown bag at The Atlantic the other day. And I was telling, you know, James, and I was telling the audience that one of the things that happens whenever, you know, something is published, you know, in The Atlantic, whenever, like, you see one of these long, long pieces, 15,000, I mean, you guys, if you could only see what happens.
We do books in short form.
Right.
Long stories.
Yeah, short form books, that's what we do.
Yeah, it's a very efficient way to get a lot of information.
But, I mean, if you guys could see, like, so, like, just to get, I mean, we'll just take, like, the mass incarceration piece, okay? So, like, the vetting for that begins with, you know, we had a good crew of sociologists up at Harvard who met with me and my editor, Scott Stossel, you know, gave us some preliminary thoughts. When we had the draft, they read it, said, this is what's wrong, this is what's right. It went through, you know, James. It went through Atlantic fact check. So you got like three or four or five people on your backside correcting every little thing. I mean, just you guys cannot imagine like how small it can get. I mean, it literally can be like, I don't know. You know, you said the incarceration rate in, you know, 1972 was 231.5 per 100,000. But that was actually the 1973 incarceration rate. And actually in that year, you know, you were about a decimal point or so off. I mean, it gets really. So I was telling you that by the time it's done, by the time all that's done, by the time I went through all those academics and historians, by the time I went through Scott and James, by the time I went through fact check, I know I'm right. I'm right. And I'll fight anybody. You know, after that, I'll fight anybody. I'll debate you right on this street corner. I'll be there. You bring your sources, I'll bring mine, and we can do this. I'm ready. You know, because it's I think that, we think of fact check and we think of that process as protecting the magazine, but it protects the writer, you know? And I don't know. I mean, your original question was, you know, we in many ways, I guess, aren't saying new things. I think the journalism is new. I think the journalism, I think that's the new part of it, you know? I think the narrative, that you know, the reported actually piece of it is new, but that much of the history, like the foundation of it, is not new, you know, and why it's treated that way. I mean, why, you know, ground has been trod by other historians who we cite in all our work. I mean,
But it shocks us.
I don't know why. I mean, that was part of, like, listening to the bio. You know, like, this notion of having, you know, well, your work has sort of changed, and no disrespect at all, but your work has sort of changed the conversation, and I'm thinking, particularly the theories that go into Between the World and Me. I mean, these are not new notions. I mean, this notion, for instance, that, you know, undergirds the whole idea that, you know, the idea of race being, you know, a social construct is old hat in academia. You know, like this, even the poetic spin that I put on it, you know, the people who believe they are white, James Baldwin said that like 30 or 40 years ago. There's nothing new in that at all. And I will happily say that. You know what I mean? I don't have, you know, I'm not here to tell you that I'm a bearer of some new knowledge. I'm really not. At my best, you know, I'm a synthesizer, you know. I think I excel at, you know, writing in a particular way to make it urgent. But the actual information.
There's a lot of new information in there.
Well, thank you.
Short, but,
thank you.
Including your own story, of course. But so why now, do you think? I mean, why are you hitting the nerve that you're hitting at the moment?
Well, I think two things happened. I think the election of Barack Obama, I think that, you know, put, you know, people's gaze in a certain way. I think the possession of cameras and everybody's smartphone, you know, and the ability to record an amount of police violence that maybe people did not understand existed or happened out there. I think that's altered things a lot. But, you know, I have to say, like, when I was doing this, or, you know, when I've done any of the work I've done for the LA, I didn't understand that was what was going to happen. You know, like, I didn't have the awareness that, okay, this, you know, this movement is going to develop, this Black Lives Matter thing is going to spring up, and people will be looking for something. You know, I was kind of writing out of an internal need, and then it just, you know, I was lucky enough to have it match up.
You know, I want to ask you about the reaction to the book. You mentioned the president. I mentioned this to you the other day, having heard you at Howard the other day. Mm-hmm. You got a lot of great questions from the audience at Howard. I heard you on the Diane Rehm show a couple days ago. And one of the astonishing things to me was Barack Obama never came up in either of those conversations. And so this, you know, the salience of this conversation about race is as great as it's been since James Baldwin's time. But, you know, we're in the seventh, almost eighth year of the first, you know, administration of a Black president. Why isn't he more part of that conversation?
Well, I thought I had an answer for that. I mean, I thought at Howard University it was because that, you know, like that conversation there was certain ground already laid, and so people were going to another level.
But you said it didn't come up with the students either over the course of the day, right?
No, it didn't. Yeah. But I mean, even among those students, I felt that they were, you know,
at a different level.
Yeah, here's my Howard University arrogance here. But no, really, I mean, that's real talk. I mean, they're not to be arrogant about. I mean, they have discussed Obama up one side and down the other by the time they get to me. You know, it's definitely true. So by the time they get to me, it's like, okay, you know, we already dealt with that. Let's, you know, talk about something else.
Do you think we all feel that way at this point?
But, you know, you made a good point about Diane Rehm. I mean, that obviously doesn't apply to that. I don't know. Maybe it's because it's towards the end. Maybe it's because certain folks have made their peace with certain things and have decided what they think. I don't really know. I don't really know.
So what has surprised you in the reaction you've gotten to the book?
The entire reaction. I mean, I'm serious. The entire thing has been shocking. I mean, from the moment that blurb came in from Toni Morrison, everything after that has been shocking. It was a surprise to actually, I mean, I guess before that blurb came in, it was a surprise to get the book done. y'all are laughing. I swear to God, I'm not. There's nobody here from my publisher, but they will tell you. No, it was a surprise to get the book done. I mean, I wish my editor was here because he will tell you. I mean, we went through like 5 drafts for this. At one point, it was so bad that I printed out the entire draft, read it, came up with an entirely different structure for it, numbered every single paragraph, and then decided which number of the paragraph should match with which section. And then instead of like doing a cut and paste job, I typed the entire manuscript back into the computer to run it through my brain again, right? I mean, that's what you got to do sometimes, that, you know, figure out where it was. But when I was doing that, I had no real, I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know where, so.
Well, I got to say, though, that you just kind of wrote that. I mean, you just filed a big story for the magazine.
I had.
And I remember you telling me that you also were working on a book. And I said, oh, how's it going? And you said, yeah, I just turned it in.
Right.
So, I don't know.
But that was probably a draft. I mean, that probably was not the book. I mean, what I probably had done was turned in a draft. And Chris, my editor, had probably told me this will not work. That's probably what happened. And because, like, you know, you ask this question about fear as a writer. I mean, you sit down, and especially with books, you are acknowledging, and even with the mass incarceration piece, you know what I mean? Like, using Daniel Patrick Moynihan. I mean, somewhere in my head is, this feels right, but this might not work. I think it's correct, but I'm not sure that this is actually, you know, it's like you write the outline, you say, okay, I think this is the structure, and that's like a mathematical theorem that you think explains X, Y, and Z, and then you go try to prove it. You know, when you have to do the writing. And by the time we got to the 4th draft and Chris said, okay, I think this is it, everything after that was shocking. And I think because every time, you know, the book receives another accolade, all I can remember is sitting in that little office in my apartment in Harlem and just being like, you know, I don't think this might not be going anywhere. And I need to be honest with myself and say, you know I got to do my best, but this might not be going anywhere. And it is amazing that, like, that's how I see this book. But everybody else sees the book after that. Like, that process doesn't even exist for them. They don't even know. You know what it's like? It's like my dad's in the audience, right? And my dad has a different perspective on me than people who know me from that introduction. It's like that, right?
Can we just take a moment to recognize Paul Coates, Ta-Nehisi's father, who's here in the audience?
But his perspective is going to be very different. You know, I mean, this is a totally, totally different perspective, you know, and it is not the perspective of that introduction. You know, I'm sure he's very proud of that introduction. So he's happy to see it. You know, good time to be alive. But it's many things that happened before that introduction. You know? And that's kind of where you are with the book. I mean, there's so much, like, you remember all of the trouble and all the stress, you know? So it's different. It's surprising.
Talk a little bit about how you were raised, actually.
Oh, my God.
Some of which features in the book.
Okay, I'm going to try not to embarrass my dad here. My dad came out of the Black Panther Party, and he was deeply, deeply influenced by the Black Consciousness Movement to the 1960s. But my dad is his own person. And what that means is that there was a standard sort of line for people like that. And we couldn't even hew to that line. Okay, so for instance, we didn't celebrate Christmas in our household, right? So people who hewed to the Black Consciousness line had Kwanzaa. But we didn't celebrate Kwanzaa either. You see, because my dad felt like Kwanzaa was fake Chris. He had some sort of argument against Kwanzaa, too. Right?
Because it was comparative or something?
You had to ask him, man. He had some sort of argument some deep, and it made sense. I mean, I didn't like it at the time, but it was a respectable, to the point that I don't celebrate Kwanzaa now. You know what I mean? Like, it was an argument against why we should not celebrate Kwanzaa. And so everything was questioned. I can remember in the 90s when people started wearing, like, the Malcolm X t-shirts with the gun. This is iconic photograph, and I talk about it in the book, Malcolm X looking out the window, and he's got the gun. And I tell this story in A Beautiful Struggle, and everybody was wearing these t-shirts, and it was very fashionable, and I came out of this conscious household, and Malcolm X was basically Jesus in my household. Why shouldn't I be able to have a t-shirt like that? My dad said, no. He said, no, you said you can't wear that. I said, what do you mean, man? It's Malcolm. And he said, no, because they're making an ideal out of the gun. It's the gun. You know what I mean? And that's what Malcolm is being reduced to, and you can't be part of that. Everything was an argument. Everything. Everything. And it still is. I mean, he read this manuscript, you know what I mean? Before, it's nice to this, you know, number one New York Times bestseller. That was not the feedback. That was not the conversation that we had. You know, and you know what? It wasn't like, you might think, like, he would object to, like, the things in here that, you know, maybe, you know, are harsh or put a hard light on him. That wasn't the beef, man. That wasn't the beef at all. I mean, he, you know, was beefing with the writing and, you know, so everything was an argument, but, you know, it was great preparation because I left my dad's house and I went to Howard University where everything was an argument. And then after I left Howard University, I studied under David Carr where everything was an argument.
At the City Paper.
At the City Paper. Yeah. And, you know, it has been the course of my life, you know. And now I have fact check where everything is an argument. You know.
So, have you seen different reactions from black readers and white readers of the book?
Yeah. Yeah.
And how would you describe, you know, in broad terms, what
well,
the difference is?
Well, if I had to break this up, I would say among white readers, there are two camps. There's a camp that says this guy, you know, hates white people. And this is, basically a work of racism. The second camp is, this guy is the one of white people. This is the guy. Read between the world and me, and you'll know what you need to know about black people. That's this is it. This is it. Here's, read this book, and you got it. It's over. And then, you know, among, you know, they're very learned and intelligent and wise and deeply intellectually curious white people who read the book and either like the book or dislike the book, you know? Among black people, it's the same thing. You have very, very learned, you know, wise, intelligent, well-read, you know, deeply curious black people who either like the book or dislike the book. And then you have, and I think this is actually the most interesting portion, then you have black people who like the book but don't understand what the big deal is. And I mean that sincerely. I'm not being critical. Like who just feel like, well, listen, what he's saying is like what we know. Right. There's actually nothing being revealed here. Why is the world going crazy over this? Why is this, you know, worthy of a MacArthur? Why is this worthy of New York Times? Why is this nominated for the National Book Award? Nothing new here. What's going on? You know, and I think what that has to do with is the very limited space within which, you know, black writers exist. Because I think the feeling is there will be a number of books published by black authors. There will be, you know, many more books that'll, you know, the idea will come about that won't be published. A certain amount get through, and, you know, hopefully when they're of a certain quality, they get hailed by an audience that is outside of the African-American community. And I think that causes some amount of angst, you know, at least among some group of black folks. You know, it's a problem. I mean, it's an actual problem.
Did you think of your, what you said, you know, in one of the interviews you gave, you said something else that surprised me a little bit. You said you were surprised when white people found what you write interesting, more or less.
Yeah.
It always surprises you when that happens. Well, you know what? Do you think of yourself as writing for a black audience or a white audience? How do you?
That's why tough does to it answer. You know, like, I guess normally.
As one of your white readers, I can tell you. Right. I've always been pretty
sorry for condescending to you. why am I surprised? And do I probably would have told you that I was writing for a black audience before. But, and in some respects that's true, but I think I'm writing for myself and I am an African American and therefore I'm writing for a black. But I don't. I think like I'm very like insular and internal about what makes me happy about the writing. And in terms of being surprised, what that has to do with is I think like previous writers, particularly during the 1990s when you know I was at Howard and I was reading writers who kind of occupy the space that I occupy now. I feel like they wrote from a perspective of holding the white reader's hand. You know, I'm going to make some concessions to you. I'm going to show you this. I'm going to show you that. And then hopefully, like, we can all come together and you'll get it.
Right.
You'll get it. And I really try to write from over here and say, no, you come to this. Come to this. This world right here is as valid as any other world. You should come to this. That sounds more defiant than it actually is, though, because I think, in general, that's what other writers do. You know, in any sort of experience, that's the kind of writing I actually like. Mm-hmm. You know, I like, you know, having to find my way, you know, within a different way. I don't want my hand hold. I don't want to be talked to like I'm 5 years old and I can't understand certain things and I need a different language to access the experience. I don't want that at all. You know, I want you to talk to me the way you would talk if I wasn't in the room. Because that's the truest representation of the experience. But it wasn't clear to me that people would want that. You understand what I'm saying? Like, it wasn't clear to me that, I mean, I guess there's an error in my thinking right there, which says, you know, if I would want that, and, you know, you respect people as intelligent, you know, readers and listeners, why wouldn't they want the same thing?
I'm going to open it up to you guys in a minute. I'm maybe ask a couple more questions. There are two mics, so if people want to start lining up, now would be a good time, or I can just keep going, because I'm very happy to do that. You called yourself an African-American writer a second ago. Mm-hmm. How do you think of... Do you think of yourself as a tribal person? I mentioned this to you before. There's this great moment, one of many great moments in the book, at Howard University, which is an extraordinary... It's just an incredible section of the book, your experience at Howard, where you encounter the great rebuttal to Saul Bellow's line about who is the Tolstoy of the Zulus. Mm-hmm. And the answer was... Oh, God, who was it?
Ralph Wilde.
It was Ralph Wilde.
Ralph Wilde.
Tolstoy is the Tolstoy of the Zulus, mm-hmm. and you realize that you've accepted Bellow's premise
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And accepted the kind of phony notion of race that mm-hmm. he would be in some way closer to Tolstoy mm-hmm. than you mm-hmm. would. Yet at the same time, you do identify yourself as a black writer. So
right.
how do you reconcile?
Well, you know, there are two things going on. There is the fact that, you know, I, growing up in the household that I am, you know, I grew up in, I am a product of the sort of black consciousness movement myself. You know, and that can't ever be gotten away from. And I think that there's some beautiful things about that. There's a way of looking at the country that comes out of that perspective that I think is excellent. At the same time, almost against myself, like I've, you know, assumed a much more cosmopolitan view of the world that I did not expect. It almost feels like it happened to me. My expectation as you talk to, say, 19-year-old me, 20-year-old me, was to live in a black world, to spend my life in a black world. That was it. I didn't really expect to go anywhere else. I didn't have any sense. And I don't even mean, like, going into the white world. I mean into the broader world, as in literally the globe.
Yeah.
Like, I just, that was not part of my framing. I guess in many ways, you know, it comes back to the fact of going to Howard, okay? One of the interesting things, Howard is this very, very black space, but the people who are coming in have a great variety of experiences, mm-hmm. even as they're coming there. And they had been exposed to things out in the world that I just had not, and they had seen things out in the world that I had not. You know, I had girlfriends there, I had, you know, romantic partners there who just had, they just knew way, way more. You know, they've just been exposed to way more, and they brought that. You know, there's a moment in the book that I talked to about eating with a young lady whose dad was Indian, and, you know, she'd spent some time in India, and we went to eat, and she was eating with her hands, and it looked so elegant to me, even though it doesn't sound. It looked incredibly, and I had never seen anything like that. And there were moments like that happening to me. You know, my wife, I mean, when she turned 30, you know, she said, I want to go to Paris, and I said, fine, go. And she said, do you want to go? And I said, well, why would I want to go? I mean, literally, that was my thinking. What's there for me? Yeah. What's there for me? And I think, like, one of the cool things is I have been around people who don't allow me to sit in spaces that maybe are more comfortable. You know, I'm constantly being pushed out. You know, I mean, from the time I was a child, I mean, my parents were constantly pushing me out. And then when I went out into the world, like the company I had, constantly pushing me towards, you know, other experiences. And so while that's like in me, like that kind of, I guess, for lack of a better word, a crude word, tribalism is with me. I'm in conflict, to be honest with you. You know, I'm in conflict. Because I can't reconcile it, you know? I mean, maybe the way to think about it is I think there are ways to identify ethnically with a group of people. And I think this is how I feel. I very much identify ethnically as an African-American. But that doesn't mean that you're not curious about the broader world, you know? And it doesn't mean that you're not, like, that you don't want to see the broader world. You know what I think about? And I'll wind this up. It's just a very interesting question. I met my wife at a period in time where, as I said, I had not seen much of the world. And my romantic partners were all African-American. And I think about now, like, if, God forbid, but, you know, this is nothing big. I mean, we've had this conversation. If we split, like, what would my romantic pool look like then? Like, as a 20-year-old, I could only see it, you know, I met Kenyatta when I was 23. There was only one way of really seeing that world. I was 21, in fact. There was no other thing, and now, you know, like, so much has changed. How would I feel? Who would I be? Who would I be, like, in that situation? And I don't know. I don't know.
What are you learning about yourself living in Paris, by the way?
Oh, man. Well, how much of an American I am. I mean, that's the first thing that's very, very clear. I mean, you know, like, people say, you know, like, African-Americans have this, you know, special affinity. They feel this special thing. But I think what they feel is that the French, the first thing they notice about them is their Americanness, which is just not an experience you can have in America. It's not possible. You know what I mean? But that's the first, you know, you go into the, you know, your cafe, your restaurant, your store, and they hear you speak your awful French. And they say, it's American. That's a stupid American. And there's some relief to that. You see, like, there's actually, like, there's a different mask. You know, you have, like, you know, there's a different, you know, way in which you're viewed. And so that's very, very different. That doesn't mean the place is, you know, less racist. It doesn't mean that they don't have issues with their own, you know, population coming out of the Maghreb, coming out of West Africa. They definitely do. But as an individual African-American being there, the experience is different. I am learning to discipline myself and humble myself to my own ignorance. Because, you know, I'm studying French over there, and I guess I thought this was like, you know, when I first started, you take a few courses and then you speak French and that's the end of it. It's not the end of it. It's very, very hard. And every day you walk out, you encounter your own failure. I was telling Samari before I left, it is as though, like, being in Paris is like every day when you leave the house on roller skates. And you don't really know how to skate. But everybody else around you has been skating from the time they were born. And they're all, you know, doing tricks, and they're spinning, and they're jumping up in the air. And you know what I mean? You're just trying to stay upright. You know, I mean, that's how it feels every day. You know, it's a great place, a great feeling to have in your life. Very invigorating.
Please help me welcome Larissa McFarker.
Thank you very much, Susan. Can you hear me? And thank you, everyone, for coming out. It's very altruistic of you to do so on this night where you could be staying at home watching the debate. So you can all be in my next book. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about why I wrote this book, because some people find it mysterious. I wrote this book because I thought that the beauty and the power of a certain kind of human life had been lost, or at least obscured, by a whole tangle of cliches and ideas about this human figure, the do-gooder. And that's why I use the term do-gooder. It's obviously somewhat pejorative. It carries a lot of baggage. And I wanted that baggage because at first when I tried to explain to people, I'm writing a book in part about why people are so skeptical and hostile towards people who do good things. They would say, what are you talking about? No, we're not. And then I would use the term do-gooder, and immediately people understand what I'm trying to say. Because I think that this, and I think it's important to untangle the real lives of do-gooders from this pastiche of cliches and social science and all kinds of other ideas, because I think that insofar as the idea of the do-gooder has become unappealing to us, it makes trying to live even a slightly more ethical life unappealing to the rest of us, even if we don't aspire to become a saintly person. And the baggage that this term carries is odd because it's conflicted. On the one hand, there's a sense that these people are strange, unhealthy, even twisted. And when I worked on this project, I talked with a lot of friends and people who said, those people, they're mentally ill, right? And I said, no, but how interesting you would say that. And when I started researching the book, I focused on people who'd given away one of their kidneys to a stranger. And I was doing that simply because I wanted to know more about these people. I thought it was an extraordinary thing to do, and I wanted to know what these people were like and what the rest of their lives were like. But I found that they encountered an enormous amount of skepticism and even hostility. Their family said, you know, if you want to give away a kidney, why a stranger? What about me? What about our children? What are you doing giving away to a stranger this very precious thing? Their friends just thought it was often bizarre. They couldn't understand why they would do such a weird thing. And even the doctors who they proposed to do the transplant surgery, and you would think that a doctor would be fairly at home with the idea of helping people, doctors also found it very, very strange. They subjected these would-be donors to a battery of psychological tests to make sure they weren't nuts. And in fact, something like, I don't know the exact percentage, but something like half the transplant programs in this country will not even deal with people who want to donate one of their kidneys to a stranger at all, on the assumption that there's something kind of wrong with them. And I became really intrigued by all this hostility and skepticism, and I wanted to investigate where it came from. And I ended up tracing a history of it through Western culture for the past 100, 150 years or so. And just to give you one example, the French anthropologist Marcel Mauss wrote a very influential book in 1925 called The Gift. And he studied traditional societies in several different parts of the world. And in these societies, he found that giving was always reciprocal. And we might think of a gift where you don't expect anything in return as a higher, more selfless act. But in these societies, that was not the case. A gift like that was aggressive because it gave you more power than the recipient. It sort of made you of a higher status and caused the recipient to lose face and look like a dependent charity case. And there was a word in some of these languages that he studied for such a gift. It was poison. On the other hand, and this is where the contradiction comes in, while some people consider these do-gooders twisted and strange, other people, or maybe even the same people, tend to consider them boring and simple. As I was studying these people, I talked to a novelist friend of mine, and I said, you novelists, why don't you write about people like this, do-gooders? And he gave me this look like I'd suggested, you know, why don't you write a nice book about bunnies and butterflies? And I thought, there's nothing, these people are not like that. They're not simple. They're not boring. And so part of my motive in this book is to give people a sense of that. And I'm going to read you a little bit about one person to get that across. His name is Baba Amte, and he established a leprosy colony in India in the 1940s, which is still going today, and it's a very well-established and quite famous institution in India now. But this is the beginning. Baba. This is the story of a man who founded a leper colony in a wilderness in the center of India, and who passed on this flourishing and celebrated enterprise to his children and their children as another man might a shipping business or a newspaper. The story began with a chance encounter one night in the rain that caused the man to change the course of his life, and everything that happened for the generations that followed was due to that decision. But things could so easily have been different. One can imagine this man in another time and place pursuing any number of ambitions with equal passion and tenacity. He might have been Henry Ford. He might have been Napoleon. If there are such things as congenital saints, he was not one of them. Here's what he started with. He was chronically restless. He craved novelty and delighted in obstruction. He despised comfort. He needed life to be difficult. He could tolerate a lot of pain, and he was fearless, and he valued those qualities in himself more than any others. One rainy night, the man passed a body lying on the side of the road. It was scarcely human. It was a leper in the last stages of the disease, naked, barely alive, his hands and feet stumps, his nose caved in, his flesh decayed and crawling with maggots. The man was repelled by this ghastly sight, and terrified that he might catch the disease, he ran. But then he realized that he had run in fear, he who was not afraid of anything. The thought of himself as fearful was more dreadful to him than the thought of catching leprosy, so he went back to the leper and covered him with a piece of cloth to shield him from the rain. The leper was past help and soon died, but for weeks afterward the man was profoundly shaken by this experience. He had been scared. He had run away. He could not tolerate this thought, but it wouldn't leave him alone. Gandhi himself had called him fearless. That was the sort of man he had been. For the first time in his life, he hated himself. He decided that the only thing that would restore his serenity was to steer directly into his fear until he was rid of it. He would make leprosy his work. He began with the idea of treating the disease. But later, after he had lived in his colony for many years, he realized that it was not just the alleviation of suffering that excited him, but the suffering itself. He believed that a person who had not felt pain, mental or physical, was incapable of strong attachments, and that shared suffering was the mortar of community. Pain broke a man open and let other people in. Suffering was at the core of what it meant to be human. His colony was held together by the suffering of the lepers, Baba believed, and because he too had been in pain for much of his adult life, he had severely degenerative arthritis and was forced to spend time in traction and months in bed. He felt himself part of that fellowship. To me, the kinship of pain has always been the strongest bond, he wrote in a poem. I could forget those with whom I laughed, but I will never forget those with whom I shed tears. His wife, Tai, wrote, "A greater affiliation with pain is what is required and is capable of transforming this world. We need no other religion." Baba decided to spend a year studying at the Calcutta School of Tropical Medicine. A professor there told him that there was no cure for the disease, in part because it appeared impossible to transmit it to animals for the sake of experiments. Baba thought about this for several days, and then he offered himself as a human experimental subject. He was injected with the leprosy bacillus and waited for his fate to be decided. He did not catch the disease. From then on, he knew he was immune, as are, it turned out later, the vast majority of humans, and had nothing to fear. As it happened, a cure for leprosy was developed shortly thereafter in 1950, the drug Dapsone. After his training in Calcutta, Baba started traveling around the area dispensing doses. He soon realized that even though the drug could cure most patients medically, it couldn't change their lives. A leprosy patient taking medicine was soon no longer contagious, but whatever awful damage the disease had already done, fingers and toes disfigured, eyebrows gone, collapsed nose, strange patches on the skin, marked him forever. Fear of leprosy was so great, and the signs of the disease so unmistakable, that even cured lepers were rejected by their families. Relatives of leprosy patients were ostracized and unmarriageable, so to keep a leprosy patient at home was to sacrifice normal life for everybody else. In many villages, lepers were burned alive. Even a cured leprosy patient faced a ruined existence. He couldn't work, he couldn't live with his family, or even in his village. He had no choice but to beg. Thus, even after a cure for leprosy had been found, leper colonies were still necessary. At the time, Christian missionaries ran a number of leprosariums in India. But dependence on charity was like death, Baba believed. This is what he was trying to get away from, treating lepers like charity cases with nothing to offer but their beggared souls for sale in return for medical assistance. He defined himself against the canon of Christian leprosy saints like Albert Schweitzer and Father Damien. Schweitzer put leprosy patients to bed, Baba said. He would put them to work. If a person had lost seven fingers, after all, he had three left, and there was a lot you could do with three fingers. A man could live without fingers, but not without self-respect. He applied to the state of Madhya Pradesh for land, and in 1951 was given 50 acres of wilderness, with rocky scrub with no water. He and his wife went to live there with their two tiny sons, 6 leprosy patients, a cow, and 4 dogs to protect them from wild animals, and 14 rupees, nearly nothing. They built 2 shelters, 4 wooden sticks and grass roof, no walls. There were deadly snakes and scorpions and rats everywhere. The leprosy patients would wake to discover that rats had eaten their insensate skin while they slept. Tigers came in the night and snatched the dogs from the huts one by one. The nearest source of water was more than a mile away. Baba named the place Anandwan, Forest of Joy. It was a measure of how hellish life was outside for the lepers that they flocked to this terrible place. More than 50 came in the next 2 years. Most were desolate when they arrived, having been thrown out by their families and rejected by their friends, but work revived them. Baba's doctors had advised him to rest in bed for nearly a year, but instead he worked maniacally, day and night, cleaning and bandaging leprous wounds, cutting wood, digging in the fields, building houses. It was one thing for Baba and Tai to impose poverty on themselves, but their children had not chosen this life. They were so poor that Vikas and Prakash had barely enough food to stave off hunger. Because the local people were afraid of leprosy, they wouldn't allow their children to play with the Amte children. They had no toys. Prakash took to playing with poisonous scorpions. They had no warm clothes. They didn't even have parents most of the time, because Baba and Tai worked from before dawn till late at night, and the boys spent their days wandering around the jungle. Baba was not distressed by this. He thought it would make his boys tough. But Tai felt guilty, since she and Baba had been pampered as children. So you see what I mean? There's nothing bunnies or butterflies about this guy. But there are things about this story that give us pause, or give me pause for sure. His children were not eaten by tigers, as the dogs were, but they might have been. And the children did not catch leprosy, but they might have done. And this is the level of risk to which a really committed do-gooder is prepared to put not only himself, but also his family. And when we usually think about do-gooders and why they irritate us, I think we usually think, well, maybe it's a matter of guilt or irritation. Even if the do-gooder doesn't say anything about how we're living our lives, we may feel implicitly rebuked that we ought to be doing more, that we ought to be changing the way we live. And that's annoying. And certainly that is true. But there's a much deeper reason that people have a problem with do-gooders, and it has to do with this conflict between strangers and family. Most of us want to give everything we can to our families, and we don't only want this. We also think that's the right thing to do. And so when we encounter someone like Baba Amte, who cares about his family, loves his sons and his wife, but is also prepared, because he cares for other people also, to put their lives at risk, that gives us pause. And the conflict in Baba Amte's case is pretty clear. In a case of another couple I wrote about, Sue and Hector Badeau, it's a little more tangled up and complicated. Sue and Hector Badeau are a couple, working-class couple from Vermont, did not have much money at all, who had 2 biological children and adopted 20 special needs kids. Special needs in the adoption context that they were, meaning that they were very unlikely to be adopted. So, for instance, at one point they adopted 6 teenagers, and they didn't have any emotional or physical disabilities, but nobody else was going to adopt 6 teenagers. They were brothers and sisters, and Sue and Hector wanted to keep their family together. And this also, I know from talking to many people, brings people up short. They think 22, that's too many. Why so many? Why don't they focus on fewer? And I should say, Hector grew up in a French-Canadian family of 16 biological kids. So for him, 22 was more, but it was not crazy like it seems to a lot of people. But still, it was difficult to make the decision each time to bring 1 more, 2 more, 6 more into the family. And as the family grew larger and the kids grew older, they would have family meetings to discuss the possibility of bringing in a new kid. And, you know, the family was not a democracy. They were very clear about that. They were going to make that decision, but they would discuss it with their kids. So each time Sue and Hector were considering adopting another child, they held a family meeting to discuss it. At first, Jose, who is the first child to be adopted, was the only one who openly questioned the need for more kids. Jose said, "There has to be another family. Our family can't take every kid in the world." The others might have had the same thoughts, but they came out in other times, in other ways. When Chelsea, the first biological kid, was 12, she was delivering newspapers, and on a steep hill, the brakes of her bicycle failed, and she was thrown violently over the handlebars onto the street. She yelled at her parents, "If you didn't adopt so many children, I could have had a new bike, and this would not have happened to me." But usually at the family meetings, the children were in favor. New small children were cute, new big children were exciting, and a new child of your own age was someone else to play with. But this time, though, the children weren't sure. Trish, we got to a point where we were like, "All right, Dad and Mom, you've got to stop adopting." Some of us got tired of it. We felt like we were helping taking care of everybody. I would feel bad because I would think to myself, how would I feel if they didn't want to adopt me because they thought we had too many kids? But I would still feel like that's enough. Isaac, I understand that there's people who need help, but you can only stretch yourself so thin. We'd ask them, "Are you sure that this is something you want to do?" And they said it was something that they needed to do, that if they didn't help this boy, then nobody was going to. And that's not something they felt they could live with, I guess. This was something that made Sue and Hector different from most people. Most people would think first about how the adoption would affect the children they had. But to Sue and Hector, the need of the child who was still a stranger weighed equally in the balance. They never told themselves that because a child was a stranger, he was not their problem. If they heard about a particular child who was suffering, they felt he was as much their problem as if he were drowning at their feet or had been left at their doorstep. Sue and Hector didn't tell themselves that someone else would adopt the child if they didn't. They knew that wasn't true. If they decided not to adopt a child, and there were many that they did not adopt, it was because they felt they could not be good parents to him for some reason, or because they worried that bringing him in would make everybody's lives worse. This was another way in which their mission was complicated. They wanted to help as many children as they could, but if they tried to help too many, then they would do harm, and there was no one to tell them where to draw that line. And many people find what they did extreme to the point of crazy. And Sue had an analogy that she likes to use when people ask her why on earth she would live her life in such an extreme fashion. She said, you know, picture someone who wants to climb Everest. That requires a lot of sacrifice, a lot of money, a lot of certainly ease and comfort, a lot of time. Maybe this person misses on important family occasions, all because they have this goal. This is their mission, the thing they want to do more than anything else. And you might look at this person and say, why? Why do you want to do this crazy thing that doesn't make sense to me? And she said, you know, I understand that reaction. I have that reaction to someone who wants to climb Everest, but why can't you accept that this is my mission? This is my purpose. This is what I want to do with my life. And it matters to me, just like what you do matters to you. So, and I think, you know, this family, it is not an orphanage. It's a family. And there have been terrible things that have happened to these kids, some of which might have been avoided, some of which were unavoidable. But they're still very close. The parents moved to Philadelphia, and most of the kids live within a couple blocks of the parents' house. They're in and out of each other's houses all the time. They're babysitting each other's kids. And every holiday, they get together for a big meal. So this is a real family. There's no question about that. And while it's true, it may be true that if they had chosen to adopt a few kids, like two or something, that they could have poured so many resources into those two kids and their two biological kids that those kids would have been better off. And most people think, well, that's the end of it. That's the answer. But to them, they would think, yeah, okay, but what about those 18 other kids who would not be part of our family, who would not have any parents at all, and whose lives would have been immeasurably worse? That, to them, is just as moving. And I guess the last thing I want to point out about these people is that it seems hard, given the extremity of what some of them have done, to believe that they draw limits, but they actually do. And this is something that's incredibly important and hard to achieve, and they've all managed it. Because many of them start out as young people with an overwhelming sense of the suffering and need in the world and a sense of obligation and debt. And you know, when I started this project, one of the questions I wanted to answer was, why don't most of us regular people give more? And because we all know that giving is pleasurable, either a small thing like a small amount of money or a seat on the bus or a large amount of money or a kidney. It often makes you happier to give something than to keep it. So why don't people give more? And I think one of the many reasons is that the idea of, if once you open your mind to the need of the world, it is such an overwhelming thought that you want to close that down again because it's panic inducing. And so therefore, and these people certainly are even more overwhelmed by it than most of us. And so shutting down, creating limits is incredibly important part of being a successful do-gooder. And these people are successful do-gooders. I'm sure there are failed do-gooders, but these are the successful ones. So here is one couple. I'm just going to read one more passage to you. A couple called Julia Wise and Jeff Kaufman. They're a young couple who live in Boston. And this is the solution they came up with. It occurred to Julia when she was quite young that she would be hellish to be married to. She was unwilling to compromise on moral questions, which meant, for instance, that she was unwilling to spend money on things that it was normal for married people to spend money on. And yet, when she was 22, having fallen in love with a young man named Jeff Kaufman, she proposed to him and they became engaged. Jeff knew about her principles, but money questions, her principles involve giving away as much money as she possibly can, did not come up much when they were still in college because their food and shelter were taken care of. So it happened that the first real moral test of their life together did not arise until after graduation. It was a sunny day in September, and they were at an apple orchard outside Boston with Julia's Morris dancing troupe. There were candy apples for sale, and Julia wanted one. Normally, I actually emailed with her the other day, and she now tells me, candy apples, they're gross. Why did I want one so badly? But she didn't know this at the time. Many things she didn't know when she was just 22. Normally, she would have told herself that she couldn't justify spending her money that way, but Jeff had told her that if she wanted anything, he would buy it for her with his money. He had found a job as a computer programmer. Julia was still unemployed, and she had no savings because she'd given everything she'd earned in the summer to Oxfam. Jeff bought the apple. Julia. It was like maybe $4? Jeff, shocked. No. Julia, it was one of those orchards. Jeff, a $4 candy apple? Julia, I don't know. Jeff, I would feel bad about that. Julia, maybe it was $3? Jeff, I don't think it was that much. Julia, I'm sure it's in the spreadsheet. That night they lay in bed and talked about money. Jeff told Julia that, inspired by her example, he was thinking of giving away some percentage of his salary to charity. And Julia realized that if Jeff was going to start giving away his earnings, then by asking him to buy her the apple, she had spent money that might have been given. With her selfish, ridiculous desire for a candy apple, she might have deprived a family of anti-malarial bed net or deworming medicine that might have saved the life of one of its children. The more she thought about this, the more horrific and unbearable it seemed to her, and she started to cry. She cried for a long time, and it lasted so long that Jeff started to cry too, which he almost never did. He cried because more than anything, he wanted Julia to be happy. But how could she be happy if she went through life seeing malarial children everywhere, dying before her eyes for want of a bed net? He knew that he wanted to marry her, but he wasn't sure how he could cope with a life that was going to be this difficult and this sad, with no conceivable way out. Then they stopped crying and they talked about budgets. They realized that Julia was going to lose her mind if she spent the rest of her life weighing each purchase in terms of bed nets. So after much discussion and fine-tuning, they came up with a system. The first and most crucial element of the system was that henceforth Jeff's money and Julia's money would be kept entirely separate. Once that was established, they could decide to do with their own money what they wished. Jeff decided he would give away 50% of his salary and keep the rest for spending and saving. Julia would give away 100% of hers. Out of the remainder of Jeff's salary, he allotted an allowance to each of them of $38 a week, which they would use to pay for everything other than rent and food, things such as clothes, shoes, transportation, and treats like candy apples. Jeff decreed that this allowance had to be spent on these things. It could not be given away, and it could not be saved, or he would donate a matching amount to the Republican Party. That threat worked. So I just end with that because this is one of the hardest things they did. You know, someone who is so morally attuned that they burst into tears at the thought of $4 deprived from a charity. And what they learned, I was on the subway the other day in New York where I live, and there's an advertisement by Con Ed trying to get people to reduce the electricity that they use. And the slogan for this campaign is "Everything Matters." And I thought, thinking of Jeff and Julia, that is a terrible slogan. You know, that is what we have to get past, because if everything matters, that is a recipe for utter madness. So these are the ones who have opened their minds to the infinite need of the world, but have also figured out there's a time when I have to close my eyes, close my mind, work out moral parameters I can live with for the long haul. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Viet Thanh Nguyen.
Thanks, John, for that lovely introduction. And as we were talking about before, John actually spent time in Vietnam, so I feel like I'm being introduced by someone who has an understanding of part of what this book is dealing about. So what I'm going to do today is read about 15 minutes from the book and save a lot of time for hopefully questions and answers and a discussion with whatever your concerns happen to be. And I'm going to start off with the first couple of paragraphs of the book, which if you listen to the radio this afternoon, you already heard that, but the rest of the reading will be different. The novel begins with the fall or the liberation of Saigon, depending on your point of view, and our protagonist is a communist spy in the South Vietnamese army, and the opening of the novel establishes his role and what he's about to do, which is to spy on the efforts of the South Vietnamese to fight their war, but then also later to spy on them as they go to the United States. I'm a spy, a sleeper, a spook, a man of two faces. Perhaps not surprisingly, I'm also a man of two minds. I'm not some misunderstood mutant from a comic book or a horror movie, although some have treated me as such. I'm simply able to see any issue from both sides. Sometimes I flatter myself that this is a talent, and although it is admittedly one of a minor nature, it is perhaps also the sole talent I possess. At other times, when I reflect on how I cannot help but observe the world in such a fashion, I wonder if what I have should even be called talent. After all, a talent is something you use, not something that uses you. The talent you cannot not use, the talent that possesses you, that is a hazard, I must confess. But in the month when this confession begins, my way of seeing the world still seemed more of a virtue than a danger, which is how some dangers first appear. The month in question was April, the cruelest month. It was the month in which a war that had run on for a very long time would lose its limbs, as is the way of wars. It was a month that meant everything to all the people in our small part of the world, and nothing to most people in the rest of the world. It was a month that was both an end of a war and the beginning of, well, peace is not the right word, is it, Commandant? It was a month when I awaited the end behind the walls of a villa where I had lived for the previous 5 years, the villa's walls glittering with broken brown glass and crowned with rusted barbed wire. I had my own room at the villa, much like I have my own room in your camp, Commandant. Of course, the proper term for my room is an isolation cell, and instead of a housekeeper who comes to clean every day, you have provided me with a baby-faced guard who does not clean at all. But I'm not complaining. Privacy, not cleanliness, is my only prerequisite for writing this confession. So the city falls, or is liberated, and he flees with the remnants of this army to Los Angeles. And his task is to spy on them as they try to organize a campaign to take back their homeland, which really did happen. I was growing up in San Jose, California during the 1980s, and I would go to these Vietnamese community celebrations, and I would see these exhibits featuring these guys in jungle uniform, camouflage uniform, somewhere in the Thai jungle, and the call was for the community to help give money to them so that they could take back, they could fight this war again. And there was a rumor that the very first Vietnamese beef noodle soup chain, Pho Hoa, was started in order to raise funds for this revolution. Never confirmed, but widely suspected by the Vietnamese community. And that also manifests itself in the novel as well. So our narrator, one of the jobs that he gets is to become the authenticity consultant for an epic Vietnam War movie that will be shot in the Philippines. This is completely fictional, has no bearing on reality. So this is what's going to happen next. He's going to go to the Hollywood Hills to meet the famous director of this movie, known only as the auteur. And the scene that I'm going to read begins with a description of the screenplay for this movie called The Hamlet. Not Hamlet, The Hamlet. All right. And two things you need to know about him, about our protagonist, is that he's half Asian. His father is a French priest, and his mother is a poor Vietnamese woman. The other thing to know about him is that he, when he was in the South Vietnamese military, his job was to be a secret policeman. Both of these details will come up. So here we go with a description of The Hamlet. We own the day, but Charlie owns the night. Never forget that. These are the words that blonde 21-year-old Sergeant Jay Bellamy hears on his first day in the torrid tropics of Nam from his new commanding officer, Captain Will Seamus. Seamus was baptized in the blood of his own comrades on the beaches of Normandy, survived another near-death experience under a Chinese human wave attack in Korea, then hauled himself up the ranks on a pulley oiled with Jack Daniels. He knows he will not ascend any higher, not with his Bronx manners and his big, knobby knuckles over which no velvet gloves fit. This is a political war, he informs his acolyte, the words emanating from behind the smokescreen produced by a Cuban cigar. But all I know is a killing war. His task, save the prelapsarian Montagnards of a bucolic hamlet perched on the border of wild Laos. What's threatening them is the Viet Cong. And not just any Viet Cong. This is the baddest of the bad, King Kong. King Kong will die for his country, which is more than can be said for most Americans. More important, King Kong will kill for his country, and nothing makes King Kong lick his lips like the ferric scent of the white man's blood. King Kong has stocked the dense jungle around the hamlet with veteran guerrillas, battle-wizened men and women, who have slaughtered Frenchmen from the highlands to the street without joy. What's more, King Kong has infiltrated the hamlet with subversives and sympathizers, friendly faces only masks for calculating wills. Standing against them are the hamlet's popular forces, a ragtag bunch of farmers and teenagers, Vietnam's own Minutemen, trained by the dozen Green Berets of the United States Army Special Forces A-Team. This is enough, Sergeant Bellamy thinks, alone in his watchtower at midnight. He's dropped out of Harvard and run far from his St. Louis home, his millionaire daddy, and his fur-cloaked mother. This is enough. This stunningly beautiful jungle and these humble, simple people. This is where I, Jay Bellamy, make my first and maybe my last stand at the Hamlet. This, at any rate, was my interpretation of the screenplay mailed to me by the director's personal assistant, the thickish manila envelope arriving with my name, misspelled, in a beautifully cursive hand. That was the first whiff of trouble. The second being how the personal assistant, Violet, did not even bother to say hello or goodbye when she called for my mailing information and to arrange a meeting with the director in his Hollywood Hills home. When Violet opened the door, she continued with her bewildering manner of discourse in person. Glad to see you can make it. Heard a lot about you. Loved your notes on The Hamlet. And that's precisely how she spoke. Trimming pronouns and periods as if punctuation and grammar were wasted on me. Then, without deigning to make eye contact, she inclined her head in a gesture of condescension and disdain, signaling me to enter. When I crossed over the threshold into the marble foyer, I instantly suspected that the cause of her behavior was my race. What she saw when she looked at me must have been my yellowness, my slightly smaller eyes, and the shadow cast by the ill fame of the Oriental's genitals, those supposedly minuscule privates disparaged on many a public restroom wall by semi-literates. I might have been just half an Asian, but in America, it was all or nothing when it came to race. You were either white or you weren't. Was I just being paranoid, that all-American characteristic? Maybe Violet was stricken with color blindness, the willful inability to distinguish between white and any other color, the only infirmity Americans wished for themselves. But as she advanced along the polished bamboo floors, steering clear of the dusky maid vacuuming a Turkish rug, I just knew it could not be so. The flawlessness of my English did not matter. Even if she could hear me, she still saw right through me, or perhaps saw someone else instead of me. Her retinas burned with the images of all the castrati dreamed up by Hollywood to steal the place of real Asian men. Here, I speak of those cartoons named Fu Manchu, Charlie Chan, Number One Son, Hop Sing, and the bucktooth bespectacled Jap not so much played as mocked by Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's. By the time I sat down opposite the director in his office, I was seething from the memory of these previous wounds, although I did not show it. Still, I was flummoxed by having read a screenplay whose greatest special effect was neither the blowing up of various things nor the evisceration of various bodies, but the achievement of narrating a movie about our country where not a single one of our countrymen had an intelligible word to say. Violet had scraped my already chafed ethnic sensitivity even further, but since it would not do to make my irritation evident, I forced myself to smile and do what I did best, remaining as unreadable as a paper package wrapped up with string. The auteur studied me, this extra who had crept into the middle of his perfect mise-en-scene. A golden Oscar statuette exhibited itself to the side of his telephone, serving either as a kingly scepter or mace for braining impertinent screenwriters. A hirsute show of manliness ruffled along his forearms and from the collar of his shirt, reminding me of my own relative hairlessness, my chest and stomach and buttocks as streamlined as a Ken doll. "Great to meet you," the auteur said. "Loved your notes. How about something to drink? Coffee, tea, water, soda, scotch. Never too early for scotch. Violet, some scotch. Ice." I said ice. "No ice then. Me too. Always neat for me. Look at my view." "No, not at the gardener. Jose! Jose!" Got to pound on the glass to get his attention. He's half deaf. "Jose! Move! You're blocking the view." "Good. See the view." "I'm talking about the Hollywood sign right there. Never get tired of it. Like the word of God just dropped down, plunked on the hills, and the word was Hollywood. Didn't God say, let there be light first? What's a movie but light? Can't have a movie without light. And then words. Seeing that sign reminds me to write every morning." "What?" "All right. So it doesn't say Hollywood. You got me. Good eye. Things falling to pieces. One O's half fallen and the other O's fallen altogether. Word's gone to shit. So what? You still get the meaning. Thanks, Violet. Cheers. How do they say it in your country?" I said, "How do they say it? Yo, 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 is it? I like that. Easy to remember. Yo, 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 then. And here's to the congressman for sending you my way. You're the first Vietnamese I've ever met. Not too many of you in Hollywood. Hell, none of you in Hollywood. And authenticity's important. Not that authenticity beats imagination. The story still comes first. The universality of the story has to be there. But it doesn't hurt to get the details right. I had a Green Beret who actually fought with the Montagnards vet the script. He found me. He had a screenplay. Everybody has a screenplay. Can't write, but he's a real American hero. Two tours of duty, killed VC with his bare hands. You should have seen the Polaroids he showed me. Made my stomach turn. Gave me some ideas, though, for how to shoot the movie. Hardly had any corrections to make. What do you think of that? It took me a moment to realize he was asking me a question. I was disoriented, as if I were an English as a second language speaker listening to an equally foreign speaker from another country. That's great, I said. You bet. It's great. You, on the other hand, you wrote me another screenplay in the margins. You ever even read a screenplay before? It took me a moment to realize there was another question. Like Violet, he had a problem with conventional punctuation. No, I didn't think so. So why do you think, but you didn't get the details right? I didn't get the details right. Violet, hear that. I researched your country, my friend. I read Joseph Buttinger and Francis Fitzgerald. Have you read Joseph Buttinger and Francis Fitzgerald? He's the foremost historian on your little part of the world. And she won the Pulitzer Prize. She dissected your psychology. I think I know something about you people. His aggressiveness flustered me. And my flustering, which I was not accustomed to, only flustered me further, which was my only explanation for my forthcoming behavior. You didn't even get the screams right, I said. Excuse me. I waited for an interjection until I realized he was just interrupting me with a question. All right, I said, my string starting to unravel. If I remember correctly, pages 26, 42, 58, 77, 91, 103, and 118, basically all the places in the script where one of my people has a speaking part, he or she screams. No words, just screams. So you should at least get the screams right. Screams are universal. Am I right, Violet? You're right, she said from where she sat next to me. Screams are not universal, I said. If I took this telephone cord and wrapped it around your neck and pulled it tight until your eyes bugged out and your tongue turned black, Violet's scream would sound very different from the scream you would be trying to make. Those are two very different kinds of terror coming from a man and a woman. The man knows he is dying. The woman fears she is likely to die soon. Their situations and their bodies produce a qualitatively different timbre to their voices. One must listen to them carefully to understand that while pain is universal, it is also utterly private. We cannot know whether our pain is like anybody else's pain until we talk about it. Once we do that, we speak and think in ways cultural and individual. In this country, for example, someone fleeing for his life will think he should call for the police. This is a reasonable way to cope with the threat of pain. But in my country, no one calls for the police, since it is often the police who inflict the pain. Am I right, Violet? Violet mutely nodded her head. So let me just point out that in your script, you have my people scream the following way. For example, when villager number 3 is impaled by a Viet Cong bungee trap, this is how he screams. Or when the little girl sacrifices her life to alert the Green Berets to the Viet Cong sneaking into the village, this is how she screams before her throat is cut. But having heard many of my countrymen screaming in pain, I can assure you this is not how they scream. Would you like to hear how they scream? His Adam's apple bobbed as he swallowed. Okay. I stood up and leaned on the desk to look right into his eyes. But I didn't see him. What I saw was the face of the wiry Montagnard, an elder of the Bru minority who lived in an actual hamlet not far from the setting of this movie. Rumor had it he served as a liaison agent for the Viet Cong. I was on my first assignment as a lieutenant and could not figure out a way to save the man from my captain, wrapping a strand of rusted barbed wire around his throat, tight enough so that each time he swallowed, the wire tickled his Adam's apple. That was not what made the old man scream, however. It was just the appetizer. In my mind, though, as I watched the scene, I screamed for him. "Here's what it sounds like," I said, reaching across the desk to pick up the auteur's fountain pen. I wrote onomatopoeically across the cover page of the screenplay in big black letters. Then I capped his pen, put it back on his leather writing pad, and said, "That's how we scream in my country." Thank you. I apologize for the screaming. It's not something you typically hear in bookstores at literary readings. It's kind of primal therapy for me. Yeah.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.